Lily Goodwin married a duke everyone in England called Broken, believing it would be nothing more than a cold arrangement between a desperate bride and a duke who needed a wife on paper. But everything began to change when she realized that behind the wheelchair, behind the cold reputation society had built around him, there was a man waging a daily war against himself. Every glance lingered a second too long. Every accidental touch felt far too dangerous. Until on a rain-soaked night in an abandoned ballroom, candlelight the only witness, she hesitated when he kissed her, her eyes dropping, just for a heartbeat, to the cane fallen on the floor beside his empty chair. Charles caught her face in his hands, drew her close, and whispered against her lips, "I'm still a man, Lily. You think I can't do this?" In that instant, she understood that the real danger at Thornwick Hall had never been his cousin, or his enemies, or the secrets locked inside the North Wing. It was falling in love with a man everyone had told her could never be a husband. London smelled of coal smoke and wet stone that morning, and Lily Goodwin sat very still in the office of Solicitor Richard Randolph, watching rain streak down glass that had not been cleaned in weeks. She was 23 years old. She wore her mother's old grey wool coat, mended twice at the elbow, and her gloves were damp through from the walk across the city, because there had been no money left for a cab. Richard Randolph sat behind a desk stacked with paper, his spectacles low on his nose, his expression the careful blankness of a man who had delivered bad news to too many families that season. "Miss Goodwin," he said, "your father's affairs were more complicated than we believed." Lily's hands folded in her lap. She had buried her father only 6 weeks earlier. Grief still sat behind her ribs, like a stone she had not learned to carry properly. And now it seemed that grief would have company. "How complicated?" she asked, "Mr. Randolph." He explained it slowly, the way one explains a wound to someone who has not yet felt the pain of it. Her father, James Goodwin, had owned and operated a textile mill, employing more than 100 families. In the last 2 years of his life, struggling against falling prices and rising debt, he had borrowed heavily. Those debts, mortgages, promissory notes, commercial paper, had been quietly purchased by a single buyer. "Lord Augustus Kensington, he holds every note against the mill," Randolph said. "If he chooses to call them due, the mill closes within the month. More than 100 families lose their income. Your aunt loses the small annuity your father arranged for her." Lily felt the cold reach into her chest. "There is a second matter," Randolph continued, and something in his tone made her sit straighter. "Shortly before his death, your father transferred a sum of money, a considerable sum, from an investment account belonging to the Kensington family estate, into the mill's payroll fund."
"That is not possible," Lily said.
"My father would never. Your brother witnessed one altered entry in the ledger," Randolph said gently. "He signed a page. He did not understand what it meant. If this matter becomes public, and if Lord Augustus wishes to press it, Samuel could be accused of participating in the fraud." Lily's throat closed around the words she wanted to say. Samuel was 19. Samuel spent his evenings sketching birds in the margins of his school books and had never told a lie convincingly in his life. "What does Augustus want?" she asked, though she already feared she knew. Randolph did not answer directly. Instead, he opened a drawer and withdrew a second folder, thicker than the first, bound with ribbon, the color of a widow's mourning band. "There is one man in England with the authority to suppress the Kensington estate's claim against your brother, and the fortune to purchase every debt Augustus holds against your mill," he said. "Charles Kensington, the 8th Duke of Thornwick." Lily had heard the name whispered in drawing rooms she had never been invited into. The broken Duke,
some called him, though never to his face, a man of enormous wealth, enormous influence, and, since a carriage crash 18 months earlier that had killed his younger brother, a man who could no longer walk. "He has made an offer," Randolph said. "He will purchase every mortgage Augustus holds against the mill. He will decline to pursue the missing estate funds. He will protect your brother from any accusation. He will secure an independent income for your aunt. He will preserve the mill and the workers' cottages for no less than 10 years. Lily's pulse beat unpleasantly loud in her own ears. "In exchange for what?" Randolph slid the folder across the desk. "Marriage," he said. "To you." Rain kept falling outside the window. Somewhere below, a cartwheel struck a loose cobblestone and rattled on. Lily stared at the folder as though it might, if she watched it long enough, transform into something less terrible. "Why?" she asked finally. "Why would a duke need to purchase a wife?" Randolph hesitated, and in that hesitation, Lily heard the shape of an answer she had not been given yet.
"His Grace's position is precarious," he said carefully.
"His cousin, Lord Augustus, has been working to persuade the family trustees and the Court of Chancery that His Grace's injuries render him medically incapable of administering the Kensington Trusts. If Augustus succeeds, the Duke retains his title, but loses control of his lands, his businesses, his fortune, and his tenants. A competent duchess, one who can host the trustees, manage the household, and demonstrate His Grace's daily capacity to govern, would be of considerable value to him." "So, I am to be evidence," Lily said quietly. "You are to be his wife," Randolph corrected, though not unkindly. "The settlement is generous, Miss Goodwin. Read it before you judge it." She read it. It took her the better part of an hour, and by the end her damp gloves had left faint marks on the pages. The terms were exactly as Randolph described. The mill saved, Samuel protected, her aunt secured. But there was one clause that made her go very still. Lily Goodwin, upon marriage, retains separate quarters within Thornwick Hall, and shall not be required to submit to physical intimacy with His Grace, at any time, without her express and voluntary consent. She read it twice, then a third time. It was, she understood slowly, a kindness, and yet it unsettled her more than any threat in the document could have. It suggested that the Duke had already decided what she would think of him, that he expected disgust, or reluctance, or a bride who would only ever tolerate his touch out of obligation. It suggested he believed himself unwanted before she had even met him. "He protects me from himself more carefully than he protects himself from me," she murmured, almost to herself. Randolph did not answer. He only held out the pen. Lily thought of Samuel's careful, frightened face when he'd told her about the ledger, his hands shaking as though the ink itself might rise up and accuse him. She thought of the mill workers she had known her whole life, Mrs. Adler, who had nursed her through a fever as a child, and old Tom Whitfield, who had taught Samuel to fish. She thought of her aunt, widowed and penniless if the mill closed, with nowhere left to go. She thought, too, of her father, and the strange, aching anger she still carried toward him. He had built the mill from nothing. He had also, in his final desperate months, mortgaged his family's future without once asking whether she was prepared to inherit the weight of it. Grief and fury sat uneasily together in her chest, and she had not yet learned how to separate them. "What manner of man is he?" Lily asked quietly, before she could stop herself. "The Duke. What do people say of him, beyond what is written in this contract?" Randolph considered his answer carefully, the way a man considers a stone, before deciding whether it is safe to stand upon. "They say he is brilliant. They say he is cold. They say,
Since the accident, he has not smiled in the company of strangers, and rarely in the company of friends.
I have met him only twice, Miss Goodwin, and on both occasions he struck me as a man carrying a great deal more than the newspapers report. It was not comfort exactly, but it was honesty, and Lily found she preferred it to false reassurance. She signed. The ink gathered at the point of the pen before spreading unevenly across her name, and Lily Goodwin felt something inside her chest close like a door. 3 days later, she stood on a platform at King's Cross Station, beneath a sky the color of wet slate, waiting to board a private saloon carriage attached to the northbound train. A woman waited beside the carriage door, tall, broad-shouldered, somewhere near 50, with the unmistakable bearing of someone who ran a household rather than merely lived in one.
"Miss Goodwin," the woman said, "I am Mabel Fitzpatrick, housekeeper of Thornwick Hall, and, on occasion, its conscience."
Lily managed a small, tired smile. "I understand I ought to be grateful for the escort." "You ought to be grateful for the tea," Mabel said, already climbing into the carriage. "It is the one luxury His Grace does not begrudge, and the one thing he can be provoked into forgiving, provided it is not brewed beyond 4 minutes. The train pulled north through a darkening countryside, and Mabel spoke of Thornwick Hall the way one might speak of an old, difficult relative, with exasperation and unmistakable loyalty threaded through every word. "His Grace dislikes dishonesty," Mabel said, watching the frost gather at the edge of the window glass. "Unnecessary sympathy and idle chatter before he has finished his coffee. He does not dislike you yet, Miss Goodwin, because he has not yet met you. I would not count on that lasting. You make him sound formidable." "He is formidable," Mabel said simply. "He was formidable before the accident, and he is more formidable now, because pain has sharpened what pride once merely polished. But formidable is not the same as cruel. Remember the difference. Most people do not." Lily turned the words over in her mind as the train carried her further from London, from everything familiar, toward a man she had agreed to marry without once having seen his face. Thornwick Hall rose out of the winter landscape like a black ship run aground on frozen earth. Gothic towers cut jagged shapes against a bruised evening sky. Long mullioned windows reflected the last grey light. A frozen lake lay beyond the gardens, bordered by bare trees standing like sentries with their arms raised. Lily noticed the grand front staircase first. Wide, ceremonial, flanked by stone lions, the kind of entrance built to receive kings. She noticed, second, that the carriage did not stop there. It rolled instead toward a side courtyard, where a level path had been laid in place of steps, wide enough for a wheeled chair, discreet enough that no arriving guest at the front of the house would ever see it used. The house had already begun to tell her the truth before she had spoken a single word to its master. Inside, she was led through a corridor smelling of beeswax and old stone, and into a library where cedar smoke mixed with the fainter, sharper scent of something medicinal. Charles Kensington sat near the window in a mahogany and brass wheelchair, upholstered in dark leather, his black coat tailored to perfection across broad shoulders that gave no hint of weakness. One hand rested on the wheel rim. A silver-framed photograph lay face down on the desk beside him, as though it had been placed there deliberately, or knocked over and left. He did not rise to greet her. He did not explain why. He simply studied her, a long, assessing look, as though she were a ledger he intended to check for errors, and said, in a voice low and dry as aged wine, "Miss Goodwin, you may sit, or you may remain standing in protest. I am told you possess considerable talent for both." Lily's chin lifted,
before she could stop it. I am told your grace possesses considerable talent for insult, before introductions have even been made. Something flickered at the corner of his mouth. Not quite a smile, but its cousin. Sit, he said, or don't. The choice, Miss Goodwin, is the entire point of this arrangement. He laid out the rules of the household in the same flat, efficient tone he might have used to dictate a business letter. The east wing was hers. No servant would enter her private rooms without permission. She could use the library, the conservatory, the gardens, the estate carriage. She could visit the tenants, provided she brought a companion or a groom. The north wing, he said, is sealed. You will not enter it. May I ask why? You may ask, he said. I am not obliged to answer. Lily held his gaze. And what rules do you set for yourself, Your Grace? For a moment, something shifted behind his eyes. Surprise, perhaps, that she had asked at all. I will never ask twice for what you refuse once, he said. You need not perform affection for my benefit in private, whatever society may require of us in public. And I will not lie to you, Miss Goodwin. I would ask the same of you. It was, Lily thought, the strangest wedding proposal. Already accepted, already signed, already inevitable, that she had ever heard delivered after the fact. And yet there was something in the plainness of it, the refusal to dress cruelty or kindness in anything but truth, that caught at her more than any pretty words could have. As she turned to leave the library, her eyes caught on a thin, dark stain beneath the cuff of his white shirt. Blood, not yet dry. He saw her looking. He did not hide his hand. He only watched her, waiting to see what she would do with the knowledge. She said nothing. She only inclined her head and left the room, and somewhere behind her ribs, a small, unwelcome curiosity had already begun to take root. The sense that whatever had happened to Charles Kensington on that bridge 18 months ago, the chair beneath him was very likely the smallest part of it. They were married 3 days later in Thornwick's small stone chapel, candlelight flickering against centuries-old glass, while frost patterned the windows outside. Charles remained seated throughout the ceremony, his spine straight, his voice steady, as he repeated his vows without a single tremor, as though daring anyone present to pity him. No one did. Lily watched the household staff gathered at the back of the chapel, Mabel dabbing at her eyes with unashamed sentiment, a tall, sharp-featured man in a captain's bearing standing rigid near the door, and understood that whatever else Charles Kensington was, he commanded loyalty that could not be bought. At the wedding dinner, Lily found her view of the table blocked by an enormous arrangement of hothouse flowers, their stems bristling like a small thorned fortress. She reached across without asking permission and moved the vase aside. Charles's brow lifted. You've disturbed Mrs. Fitzpatrick's careful arrangement. They appeared frightened of you, Lily said, straightening the last stem. I thought it best to give them room to recover their courage. For the first time since she had arrived at Thornwick, Charles Kensington laughed, a short, startled sound, quickly suppressed, as though laughter itself were a habit he had forgotten he still possessed. You will find, Miss Goodwin, he said, recovering his composure with visible effort, that Thornwick's household is not accustomed to being rearranged without warning. Then Thornwick's household, Lily replied evenly, shall have the benefit of learning something new tonight, along with the rest of us. Mabel, seated further down the table, made a small strangled sound into her wine glass that might have been a laugh or a cough, and did not meet anyone's eye for the remainder of the meal. Even the visiting magistrate's wife, seated near the head of the table, offered Lily an approving glance, as though she, too, had grown tired of watching Thornwick's household tiptoe around its master. Charles said nothing further on the matter, But Lily noticed, for the remainder of the dinner, that he watched her with a new and careful attention, not the wary assessment of a man cataloguing a stranger's flaws, but something warmer, more curious, as though he had discovered, quite by accident, that his wife might prove considerably more interesting than the contract had promised. Later, as the guests departed and the house settled into its late-night quiet, Lily lingered in the corridor outside her new chamber, unwilling yet to surrender the strange, unfamiliar warmth of the evening to sleep. Charles found her there, his chair moving softly over the carpet, a single candle in his hand. "You did well tonight," he said, an unfamiliar gentleness in his voice. "Better than well. The magistrate's wife has not stopped speaking of you since the soup course." "I merely moved some flowers," Lily said, though she could not quite hide her pleasure at the praise. "You did considerably more than that," Charles said. "You reminded this house what it feels like to be lived in, rather than merely maintained." He hesitated, something vulnerable crossing his composed features before he mastered it again. "I had forgotten, I think, that such a thing was possible." Lily studied him in the candlelight, the careful control, the flicker of something softer beneath it, and felt, for the first time since Randolph's office, that the bargain she had made might yet become something worth far more than the sum of its careful clauses. "Good night, Your Grace," she said softly. "Good night, Duchess," he replied, and something in the careful warmth of his voice followed her into sleep long after his candle had disappeared back down the corridor. Later that night, alone in the unfamiliar quiet of her new rooms in the East Wing, Lily found a silver cuff button lying on the corridor floor near the entrance to the sealed North Wing. Beside it, a narrow smear of blood, still faintly damp, marked the pale stone. She could not tell if it belonged to Charles. She could not shake the feeling, as she carried the button back to her room and turned it over in her fingers, that the story she had been told in Richard Randolph's office was only the barest outline of a much darker truth, and that she had just married her way into the middle of it. Lily set the button on her dressing table beside her mother's cameo and sat for a long while in the dark, listening to the house settle around her, old wood creaking, wind pressing at the window panes, the distant murmur of servants banking the fires for the night. She thought of Charles's steady, unreadable eyes across the library desk, of the dry humor buried beneath his formality, of the blood he had not troubled to hide from her. A man who concealed nothing, she thought, and yet concealed everything. She fell asleep, still turning the puzzle of him over in her mind, and dreamed, for the first time since her father's funeral, of something other than grief. Winter settled over Thornwick Hall with a heaviness that seemed to seep into the stone itself, and Lily spent her first weeks as Duchess learning the shape of a household built around a man who refused to acknowledge his own limitations. She found the estate ledgers in the library one grey morning, and what she found troubled her more than she expected. Coal was burned lavishly in unused East Wing rooms, while the workers' cottages on the northern edge of the estate stood with broken shutters and leaking roofs. She brought the figures to breakfast. Charles set down his coffee with the precision of a man controlling his temper. "You have been reviewing my accounts, miss," he stopped himself. "My Duchess." "Someone ought to," Lily said, sliding the ledger across the table. "Four cottages on the northern boundary have not been repaired in 3 years. The repairs would cost less than what this house spends heating rooms. No one enters." "And you determined this in a fortnight?" "I determined this in an afternoon," Lily said. "The fortnight was spent working up the nerve to tell you." Charles studied her for a long moment, and something in his expression, not quite approval, but its careful, guarded shadow, passed over his face. "See that the repairs are made," he said finally, and returned to his coffee, as though the matter were entirely unremarkable.
"That is all," Lily said, surprised despite herself. "No argument. No demand that I explain myself further."
Charles glanced up, one dark brow raised.
"Did you come prepared for an argument, Duchess?"
"I came prepared for several," Lily admitted. "I had rehearsed at least 3 separate defenses on the carriage ride down to breakfast."
"A waste of good rehearsal, then."
Something almost fond flickered across his face before he schooled it away again.
"I did not marry a decorative wife, Miss Goodwin, whatever the trustees may have expected of me. If you find an error in my accounts, I would rather hear it over breakfast than read about it in a magistrate's report 5 years hence."
Lily found, to her own quiet astonishment, that she believed him. It was the first time she understood that Charles Kensington, whatever else he was, respected competence more than he resented interference, and the first time she allowed herself to wonder whether the cold, formidable Duke described to her by half of London might, in fact, be a far smaller portion of the truth than the rumors suggested. They traveled together to the mill and the tenant cottages the following week, the carriage wheels crunching over frost-hardened roads. The cold worsened whatever pain lived in Charles's legs. Lily saw it in the tightness around his mouth, the way his jaw set when the carriage struck an uneven rut in the road. She reached without thinking and drew a woolen rug over his knees. He stiffened immediately, his hand closing over the edge of the fabric as though to push it away.
"I am cold merely looking at you," Lily said, before he could speak. "Accept the blanket as pure selfishness on my part, Your Grace. I have no wish to shiver on your behalf."
Charles's mouth twitched, not quite a smile, but close enough that Lily counted it a small victory. He did not remove the rug. That evening, before a formal dinner with a visiting magistrate, Lily struggled at the small mirror in her room, with a pearl button on her long glove, her fingers too cold and clumsy to manage the tiny clasp. Charles appeared in her doorway. She had not heard the wheels on the carpet, and without a word, wheeled closer and took her wrist in his hand. His fingers were warm, despite the winter chill of the house. He fastened the button with a careful, unhurried precision that seemed at odds with the brisk efficiency he brought to everything else. When it was done, his thumb rested, just for a moment, over the pulse point inside her wrist. Neither of them spoke of it, but Lily felt her heartbeat quicken beneath his touch, and she suspected, from the sudden stillness in his face, that he had felt it too.
"There," he said, his voice rougher than the simple task warranted. "You will not embarrass Thornwick's household with a loose glove, at least."
"I am obscurely grateful," Lily said, "though I confess I had not realized a duke's education included the fastening of ladies' gloves."
"It did not," Charles said. "I learned it from my mother, once, when her own hands shook too badly with illness to manage it herself. I have not had occasion to use the skill since."
Something in the admission, small, unguarded, offered without his usual armor of dry wit, caught at Lily more than any grand declaration could have. She studied his face in the candlelight, the careful control he wore like a second coat, and wondered how many such small, buried kindnesses lived beneath it, waiting for someone patient enough to find them. He withdrew his hand first, and wheeled away without another word, but the warmth of his touch lingered on her skin long after he had gone, and Lily found herself, quite against her own better judgment, looking forward to the following evening's dinner, rather more than she cared to admit. The library became, without either of them quite intending it, a place where small truths were occasionally allowed to surface. Lily found Charles there one evening, staring at the same silver-framed photograph she had noticed on her first day. 2 young men in riding clothes, laughing at something beyond the frame, sunlight caught in their hair.
"That is John," Charles said, without looking up, before she could ask. "My brother. He died in the crash that did this to me." He gestured, briefly, toward his own legs, his voice flat with the effort of keeping it that way. "He took the reins that night, because I had a headache, and asked him to drive in my place. He died in the seat that should have been mine." Lily crossed the room without deciding to. She rested her hand over his on the desk. Charles pulled away, as though her touch had burned him. "Don't," he said, low and rough. "Don't touch me, because you pity me."
"I touched you," Lily said, steady, despite the sting of his rejection.
"Because you told me something true. That is not pity, Your Grace. That is respect." He said nothing, but he did not wheel away, either, and Lily counted that too, as a kind of answer. It was two nights later that she heard him fall. She had not been asleep. Grief and unfamiliar rooms rarely allowed her easy rest. When she heard, through the wall separating her chamber from the corridor, an uneven dragging sound, followed by restrained, effortful breathing, and then a heavy, muffled impact against the floor. Lily rose at once, her heart hammering, and crossed to her door. She pressed her palm flat against the cool wood. She did not open it. Every instinct told her to rush to him, to help, to see for herself that he was not badly hurt. But something quieter and wiser held her still. Charles Kensington had built his entire existence around the fear of being seen as weak. If she burst through that door uninvited, she would take from him the one thing he had left, the right to fail without an audience. So she stood, her hand against the wood, and she waited. She heard him breathing hard in the corridor. She heard the scrape of the chair being righted, the slow, grinding effort of a man dragging himself back into it by strength of will alone. She heard, eventually, the wheels moving again, slow and steady, away down the corridor. Only then did she let her hand fall from the door, and only then did she allow herself to cry, silently, for a man too proud to ask for the help she would have given gladly. The following morning, Charles found her in the breakfast room, before she had even poured her tea. His face was drawn, his eyes shadowed with exhaustion and something sharper, humiliation, barely leashed. "You heard," he said. It was not a question. Lily met his gaze without flinching. "Yes, and yet you did not come in. You did not ask me to." Something in his rigid posture seemed to crack, just slightly, at that. "I am sending you back to London," he said. "This arrangement was a mistake." "No," Lily said. He blinked, as though he had expected any response but that one. "I beg your pardon. I said no, Your Grace. I will not go." Lily set down her cup with deliberate calm. "You fell last night. I heard it. It changed nothing about what I think of you. Except perhaps to confirm that you are far too stubborn to call for help, even when help is standing directly outside your door." Charles stared at her for a long moment, something raw and unguarded moving behind his eyes. "Most people," he said finally, quietly, "cannot bear to watch a man fail."
"I did not watch," Lily said. "I waited. There is a difference, Your Grace, and I would ask you to learn it." He did not send her away. Days later, crossing the long gallery toward the trustees' meeting room, one wheel of Charles's chair suddenly locked and dragged sideways. The chair pitched. A tall, broad-shouldered man, Captain William Clark, Lily would soon learn, Charles's oldest friend and head of estate security, caught the chair before it overturned entirely, his hands steady with the ease of long practice. Dr. Benedict Wallace, summoned at once, examined the wheel and pronounced it ordinary mechanical wear, nothing more. Lily knelt afterward and examined the fastening herself, once the men had gone. The metal edge had not simply worn thin, it had been filed, deliberately, carefully, in a place no ordinary use would ever reach. She said nothing to Charles that evening. He had asked, tightly, for the matter to remain quiet until after the trustee's visit, and she respected the request, though it sat uneasily in her chest, like a stone she could not put down. That night, returning to her room, she found a letter she had written to Samuel, missing from her writing desk, the drawer left very slightly ajar. On her dressing table, in its place, lay a single white camellia, the flower, she would later learn, that Lord Augustus Kensington habitually wore in his buttonhole. Lily had never met Augustus Kensington, and yet, somehow, he had already found his way inside her room. She spent that night composing and discarding a dozen ways of telling Charles what she had seen, and settled in the end on none of them. Suspicion without proof was a fragile thing, easily dismissed by a man already weary of being watched and questioned by physicians, trustees, and cousins alike. She resolved instead to watch quietly, the way her father had once taught her to read the mill's account books for the single figure that did not belong, not by searching for what was wrong, but by noticing what refused to sit easily beside everything else. It was a discipline that would serve her well in the weeks to come, though she did not yet know how dearly it would be tested. The sound woke her past midnight, low, ragged, unmistakably pain rather than sleep. Lily rose and followed it to Charles's chamber, where she found him feverish, a wound near his hip reopened, and seeping through the linen of his shirt, the sheets damp with sweat despite the cold. "Get out," Charles ordered, his voice thin with fever and fury both. "I did not summon you." "No," Lily agreed, already reaching for the basin of water on his washstand. "You did not. I came regardless." She worked with steady, practiced hands, cleaning the wound, while Charles's breath came shallow and uneven beneath her touch. His shirt lay open at the shoulder, his skin fever hot beneath her fingers, and when she pressed too near the wound, his hand shot up and closed around her wrist. Not to stop her, she realized, but simply to hold on to something solid while the pain moved through him. "You do not have to do this," he said through gritted teeth. "I know," Lily said, her voice quiet and even. "That is precisely why the choice belongs to me." Something in him seemed to loosen at that, not the pain, but the fight against her presence, and he let her finish the dressing without further protest, his hand remaining curled loosely around her wrist, long after the bleeding had stopped, as though he had forgotten to release her, or did not wish to. The candle beside the bed burned low, throwing gold across the sharp planes of his face, softened now by fever and exhaustion into something younger, more unguarded than the composed Duke who ruled Thornwick's breakfast table. Lily found herself studying him in the quiet, the dark lashes lowered against his cheek, the faint tremor still moving through his shoulders, the way his breathing slowly eased beneath her steady hands. "Why do you stay?" he murmured, half lost to sleep, his voice thick and unguarded in a way it never was by daylight. "Randolph's contract does not require this of you." "No," Lily agreed softly, drawing the blanket higher over his chest. "It does not." She did not offer a further answer, because she did not yet trust herself to say it aloud, that she had begun, somewhere in the cold week since her arrival, to want to stay, for reasons that had nothing to do with contracts at all. Charles's hand tightened once more around hers before sleep finally claimed him, and Lily sat beside him long after his breathing had evened, unwilling to surrender the strange, fragile tenderness of the hour. The medicine troubled her more than the fever did. The tonic Dr. Wallace administered carried a bitter, familiar smell, the same sharp undertone she remembered from a sedative once prescribed to her own father in his final illness, a medicine that had left him foggy and weak long before his heart finally failed. When she raised the question the next morning, Benedict Wallace's affable manner cooled instantly. "I have treated His Grace's condition for 18 months, Your Grace," he said, addressing her title with a faint, condescending emphasis. "I would advise against a duchess practicing medicine on instinct alone. Movement is dangerous for him. Complete rest is the only path to whatever recovery remains possible." Lily said nothing further, but the unease did not leave her. It was 2 days after the fever broke that Lord Augustus Kensington arrived at Thornwick, and Lily understood at once why society found him so easy to like. He was handsome in an effortless, unstudied way, his smile quick and warm, his manner attentive without being overbearing. He found her in the conservatory, among the ferns and the damp green smell of growing things, and spoke to her as though they were already old friends. "You must find it difficult," he said gently, "married to a man who cannot walk you into a ballroom. Charles married you to satisfy the trustees, you understand. Nothing more. I would not wish to see you trapped in an arrangement built on his ambition rather than your happiness." "That is a great deal of concern," Lily said carefully. "From a man I have known for less than an hour." Augustus's smile did not falter. "Family looks after family, Duchess. Even family Charles no longer trusts," he asked, in the same easy tone, about her father's papers, about Samuel, about whether she had traveled beyond Thornwick since her arrival, and to whom she wrote her letters. Lily answered carefully, revealing nothing, but she noted every question and stored them away like a woman gathering evidence without yet knowing what case she was building. "You do not trust me, Duchess," Augustus observed, tilting his head with an easy, disarming smile. "Understandable, perhaps, given how little you know of this family, but I would remind you that Charles is not the only Kensington capable of protecting what matters to you." "I have not asked for protection, my lord," Lily said, matching his lightness with her own. "I have found, so far, that I am rather capable of managing on my own account." Something flickered behind his eyes at that, not quite anger, but a faint, cold recalculation, as though she had stepped outside whatever role he had assigned her in his mind. He recovered his smile quickly enough, bowed with practiced grace, and excused himself to find Mabel about the arrangements for dinner. Lily remained among the ferns a long while after he had gone, her arms wrapped around herself, despite the conservatory's warmth, certain now that Lord Augustus Kensington's charm was a well-tailored coat worn over something considerably colder beneath. Below stairs, a lighter thread of the household continued its own quiet rhythm. Mabel's niece Phoebe, visiting for the season, had taken an immediate and unconcealed interest in Captain William Clark, whose stern composure seemed to amuse rather than discourage her.
"Does he ever smile?"
Phoebe asked Mabel over the kitchen fire. "When circumstances require it," Mabel said dryly. "Then I shall endeavor," Phoebe announced, "to become a circumstance." It was the kind of small warmth Thornwick badly needed, and Lily, catching sight of it from the corridor, allowed herself a rare, unguarded smile of her own. Unable to shake her suspicion of Benedict Wallace's medicine, Lily wrote quietly to Richard Randolph, and through him arranged for an independent physician, Dr. Elias Sterling, to examine Charles under the guise of a routine consultation. Elias's findings, delivered privately to Lily 2 days later, confirmed what she had feared. Charles retained meaningful sensation and muscular response in both legs, far more than Benedict's reports to the trustees suggested. "The dosage of his sedative," Elias said gravely, "was excessive by any reasonable medical standard. sufficient to explain the persistent fatigue, the fogged concentration, the slow erosion of strength Charles had come to accept as inevitable. When Charles learned what Lily had arranged, his anger was immediate and cold.
"You had no right," he said, his voice low with fury. "My medical care is not a matter for your interference."
"If obedience to your physician is what weakens you," Lily said, refusing to back down, "then it is not discipline, Your Grace. It is surrender, and I did not marry a man who surrenders."
They did not speak for 2 days. She found him on the third evening in the conservatory, rain drumming against the glass roof overhead, the air thick with the green smell of damp earth. He did not send her away.
"I released Adeline," he said, without preamble, staring at the rain rather than at her.
"My former fiancé. Society believes she abandoned me after the accident. The truth is that I overheard her mother questioning whether I could ever give her children. I decided, before Adeline could decide for herself, that her desire to remain with me could not possibly be real."
"You decided for her," Lily said quietly, "instead of allowing her to choose."
"Yes." The word came out rough, honest, unguarded in a way Lily had not yet heard from him.
"Pity so often wears the same face as affection, Miss Goodwin. I have never learned to tell them apart until it is too late."
Lily reached across the small space between them and offered her hand, palm up, open, asking nothing. Charles looked at it for a long moment. Then, slowly, he covered her hand with his own and left it there while the rain moved steadily against the glass, and neither of them spoke again for a long while, because nothing further needed saying.
It was the first touch he had ever chosen freely. Lily noticed, in the days that followed, Clara Robinson, her own lady's maid, speaking in low, urgent tones with Augustus near the servant's stair. A page later went missing from her correspondence book. Lily said nothing to Clara directly, but she began watching her with quiet, careful attention. The chapter's unease came to a point on a cold afternoon when Lily, crossing the gallery above the entrance hall, saw Augustus unlock the door to the sealed north wing and slip inside. Before he vanished through the doorway, he looked up, directly, deliberately, toward the window where Lily stood. He had known she was watching, and Lily understood, with a cold certainty settling low in her stomach, that whatever Augustus Kensington wanted from Thornwick Hall, he was no longer being careful about who saw him searching for it. The winter assembly arrived like a tide, filling Thornwick Hall with carriages, silk, wet cloaks, and the particular perfume of aristocratic judgment. The Kensington family trustees came first, followed by titled guests, eager to see for themselves whether the broken Duke could still command a household. Lily moved through it with a composure that surprised even herself, directing servants, soothing an offended dowager, correcting a menu error before the trustees noticed it at all. She watched Charles observe her across the crowded drawing room, something unreadable and increasingly warm behind his careful expression. Lady Adeline Randolph arrived among the guests, and Lily braced herself for jealousy, for coldness. She received neither. "He expects everyone to leave," Adeline told her gently, over tea in a quiet corner of the drawing room. "When they do not, he finds some way to send them first, so the leaving is his choice rather than theirs. I loved him once. I understand him still. Be patient with his fear, Duchess. It runs deeper than his legs." Augustus asked Lily to dance that evening, and refusing without a public scene proved impossible. He held her at a careful, correct distance, his voice pitched low enough that only she could hear. "A pity," he murmured, "that Charles cannot give you a complete marriage. A woman as vital as you deserves a husband who can walk beside her, not merely watch from the edge of the room. Lily's spine straightened. You mistake incompleteness for weakness, my lord. I have found neither in your cousin. Augustus only smiled, unbothered, and Lily understood that his cruelty was of a particularly dangerous kind, the sort dressed so carefully in concern that it could wound without ever appearing to strike at all. Later, Charles found her near the fire. "Did you enjoy the dance?" he asked, his tone deliberately light. "Lord Augustus spoke without interruption," Lily said. "That," Charles said, something taut beneath his calm, "was not the question I asked." Lily met his eyes and said nothing further, and the silence between them carried more honesty than any answer could have crept. 2 nights before the assembly's final ball, Charles asked Mabel to clear the small drawing room, and there, seated in his chair, with Lily standing before him, he taught her the steps of a waltz he could not dance standing. "Left hand here," he instructed, guiding her palm to his shoulder. "Your other hand in mine. Now, step, and turn." Lily moved carefully between his knees, her skirts brushing against the polished wheels of his chair, his hand warm and sure at her waist as he turned the chair in slow time with her steps. Their faces came close enough that Lily forgot, for several long moments, to count the beats at all. She was aware only of his breath, warm against her cheek, and the low, private laugh he gave when she missed a turn. "You are counting under your breath," Charles said, amusement warm in his voice. "I can hear you, you know." "I am concentrating," Lily said primly, though her cheeks had warmed considerably. Some of us were not born knowing how to turn a room without moving our feet, a skill I confess I once took entirely for granted. Something wistful crossed his face, quickly hidden. "I was considered rather good at this, before. John used to complain that I monopolized every partner worth having at a ball." "And now you monopolize me instead," Lily said softly, from a chair, in an empty room, with no one watching. Charles's hand stilled at her waist. His eyes, when they met hers, had lost every trace of teasing. "Is that a complaint, Duchess?" "No," Lily whispered. "It is the truest thing that has happened to me since I arrived at Thornwick." The air between them seemed to thicken, charged with something neither of them had yet given a name. Charles's thumb moved, slow and deliberate, against the fabric at her waist. Lily's breath caught. They came close to something neither of them named. A footman's knock at the door broke the moment before either could close the distance further, and Charles's hand slid from her waist with obvious reluctance. The forged letter appeared the following morning, tucked among the correspondence on the breakfast table, where any guest might have seen it first. Written in a hand disturbingly close to Lily's own, it suggested, in intimate, damning detail, that the Duchess intended to elope with Lord Augustus before the season's end. The drawing room, when Charles read it aloud in cold fury, went utterly silent. "This is a forgery," Charles announced, his voice carrying to every corner of the room, "and any guest who repeats its contents will find themselves unwelcome at Thornwick permanently." He defended her without hesitation, without a flicker of doubt in his public bearing. But later, in the privacy of the library, his composure cracked. "Tell me none of it is true," he said, quieter, and beneath the words, Lily heard the fear he could not fully hide. The wound of it went deep. "You defended your Duchess before them," she said, her voice unsteady with hurt. "And yet you doubt your wife the moment the doors are closed. I had hoped, Your Grace, that you might trust me where no one else could see." She left him standing, sitting, alone in the library, and did not return that night. Grief and anger drove her, the next afternoon, to follow Augustus when she saw him slip once more toward the sealed north wing. She waited until he had gone, then found the door left carelessly unlatched, and entered. Dust lay thick over rooms preserved exactly as John Kensington had left them. Riding boots by the door, a half-finished letter on the desk, a worn military campaign chest beneath the window. Inside old ledgers, Lily found records of strange, irregular transfers moving through Kensington family trusts and unfamiliar railway companies, and beneath them, a letter, in John's own hand, dated the day of the fatal crash, declaring his intent to confront Augustus that very night. Lily's hands trembled as she read it. John had known. John had died knowing. Footsteps sounded in the corridor outside. Augustus, returning. Lady Adeline, appearing as though by providence, intercepted him with bright, deliberate chatter about a mutual acquaintance, delaying him long enough for Lily to slip from the north wing unseen. That evening, cornered gently by Lily's quiet, unaccusing questions, Clara Robinson finally broke.
"He threatened my brother,"
Clara whispered, tears standing in her eyes.
"Gambling debts. Lord Augustus purchased them and swore to see my brother imprisoned unless I copied your letters, reported your movements."
"I did not know he meant to use my hand to forge that letter. I would never have..." Her voice broke entirely. Lily, thinking of her own bargain, of the debts and duties that had bound her own choices, found she could not summon anger for Clara, only recognition. "He visits the abandoned ballroom often," Clara added, wiping her eyes. "Late at night, I have seen the candlelight beneath the door." Lily went to the ballroom that same night, expecting to find Augustus. Instead, she found Charles. He lay on the dusty floor beside his overturned chair, a leather brace strapped beneath his trouser leg, his cane fallen well beyond his reach, his breath coming hard with exertion and pain both. He had been practicing, alone, in secret, night after night, for reasons Lily did not yet understand. His shirt clung damp to his back with the effort of hours of solitary struggle. Sweat darkened his hair at the temples. The candlelight caught the strain still written across his features, and for a long moment, Lily simply stood in the doorway, her heart aching with a tenderness so fierce it frightened her more than any danger Augustus or Benedict had yet posed. She had come to this house believing she would find a cold transaction and an embittered aristocrat who wanted nothing from her but the appearance of a wife. Instead, she had found a man who practiced alone in the dark, rather than admit, even to himself, how much he wanted something as simple as a single dance. And in that moment, seeing him there, proud, humiliated, and utterly unable to hide either, Lily understood that the story she thought she had been living was about to change completely. Lily did not rush toward him. She had learned, by now, exactly what rushing would cost him. "Would you permit me to help?" she asked quietly, from the doorway. "Or shall I close the door and leave you to it?" Charles's jaw tightened, humiliation burning bright in his eyes, even in the dim candlelight. For a long moment, he said nothing. Then, low and rough, "Help me." She crossed to him and knelt, working with careful, steady patience, positioning the chair, bracing herself, as he used what strength remained in his arms to drag himself upward, his breath ragged with the effort, a fine tremor running through muscles pushed past their limit. It took long minutes. Neither of them spoke until he was settled again, his chest heaving, his pride in ruins, on the ballroom floor beside the brace he had unbuckled with shaking hands. "Why?" Lily asked finally, gently. "Why have you been doing this alone, night after night?" Charles stared at the dark windows rather than at her. "I overheard you tell Mabel," he said, "that you had never danced with a man you loved. I wished. He stopped, furious at his own honesty, and started again in a harder voice. I wish to give you one turn about this room at the assembly. A foolish wish for a man who cannot stand unaided for more than a minute. That is not foolish, Lily said, her chest tight with an emotion she did not yet have a name for. Do not, Charles said sharply, mistake this for anything but what it is. You did not marry a man capable of loving you the way you deserve, Miss Goodwin. You married a debt, repaid in flesh and title. I would not have you confuse gratitude with desire. Something in Lily broke open at that. Not sorrow, but a fierce, protective anger on his behalf, aimed squarely at the fear that had convinced him he was owed only pity. You are not afraid, she said, stepping closer, that I see a damaged man, Charles. You are afraid that I see a man at all. A man who can need something. A man who can fail in front of someone and still be loved afterward. A man who can want, desperately, foolishly, something he cannot entirely command. You know nothing of what I want, Charles said, his voice dropping to something rougher, darker. Then show me, Lily whispered. He reached for her slowly, giving her every chance to step back, his hand trembling as it traced the line of her jaw. She did not move away, and when he finally closed the distance and kissed her, it carried the full weight of 10 weeks of restraint. Every avoided glance at breakfast, every withdrawn touch, every argument that had concealed a hunger neither of them had dared to name. Lily's fingers curled into the front of his coat. His hand spread warm and possessive at the small of her back, drawing her closer, and she went willingly, the last careful distance she had kept between them for 10 long weeks finally, completely gone. His other hand slid to cradle the back of her neck, his fingers threading gently into her hair, and when he deepened the kiss, she felt the low, helpless sound he made against her mouth, as though restraint itself had finally cost him more than he could bear to keep paying. She had imagined, in the quiet hours before sleep, what it might feel like to be wanted by this man. Truly wanted, not merely tolerated, not merely accepted as the price of a bargain honorably kept. She had not imagined it would feel like this, a slow, unraveling heat that began somewhere beneath her ribs and spread outward, until her hands trembled against his shoulders, until she could think of nothing beyond the warmth of his mouth and the low, unsteady rhythm of his breathing. The candlelight caught the brass edge of his chair, and rain moved steadily against the tall windows, and for one perfect, suspended moment, there was no debt between them, no title, no fear, only the slow-burning ache of two people finally allowing themselves to want. Then Lily drew back, half an inch, her breath unsteady, overwhelmed by the sudden depth of what she felt. Her eyes fell, involuntarily, toward the fallen cane on the floor. Charles saw the glance. Every ounce of warmth drained instantly from his expression, replaced by something raw and wounded. His hand loosened at her waist, giving her the room to flee that his pride demanded he offer, even as his voice broke rough and low with the fear beneath it. I'm still a man, Lily, he said. You think I can't do this? Lily's breath caught. She understood, finally, fully, the question buried beneath his anger. Not whether his body could hold her, but whether any woman could ever want him, and not merely endure him. I never doubted what you could do, she said softly, closing the distance he had opened. I doubted what would become of me, once I allowed myself to love you completely. That is what frightened me, Charles. Not your chair. The certainty that loving you would mean I could never again pretend this marriage was only a bargain. Do you wish to leave? He asked, his voice barely above a whisper. No. Are you certain? Ask me again, Lily said. And I shall answer the same. Every time you ask it. She crossed the ballroom and closed the doors herself. What followed was not spoken of afterward, in words either of them chose to repeat, but it lived in the small, unmistakable changes between them, in the way Charles's hand found hers beneath the breakfast table the following morning, in the soft, unguarded look on his face, when Mabel knocked to ask, with poorly concealed amusement, whether breakfast should be served in the East Wing, the Duke's chamber, or what she diplomatically termed neutral territory. Lily wore his dressing gown that morning, curled beside him in a room warmed by firelight, and something gentler than either of them had expected to find at Thornwick Hall. Charles admitted, quietly, that he had feared she would wake regretting her choice. "I do not regret it," Lily said, pressing a kiss to his knuckles beneath the coverlet. "I regret only the 10 weeks we wasted arguing about coal and cottages before admitting the truth." Charles laughed, a real laugh this time, warm and unguarded, and Lily thought she had never heard a more beautiful sound in her life. "I have spent 18 months, he admitted, quieter now, his fingers tracing idle patterns against the back of her hand, believing that whatever a woman might feel for me could only ever be gratitude, or duty, or pity, dressed carefully enough to be mistaken for affection. "I did not expect to be proven wrong so thoroughly, or so soon." "You were not entirely wrong," Lily said, resting her head against his shoulder. "I did feel gratitude once, and something very near duty, in the beginning, when I first signed that contract in Randolph's office. But neither of those feelings survived very long inside this house, Charles. They could not compete with the man I actually found here." He pressed a kiss to her temple, unhurried, as though he intended to memorize the shape of the moment. "Then I am glad," he murmured, "that Thornwick proved more persuasive than its master's reputation." "Thornwick," Lily said, smiling against his skin, "had considerable help." They lay together a while longer in comfortable silence, the fire crackling low in the grate, rain finally softening outside the window into a gentler patter. Lily traced idle patterns across his chest, feeling the steady rhythm of his heartbeat beneath her palm, and thought, with a quiet, settled certainty, that whatever trials still lay ahead of them, she had found something in this cold northern house worth every risk it had cost her to claim it. "I ought to warn you," Charles said eventually, his voice heavy with contentment, "that Mabel will have half the household aware of last night's arrangements before we have even finished our tea." "Mabel," Lily said, "has likely known since before we knew ourselves. I suspect she arranged the entire matter through sheer force of will and strategically placed rugs." Charles's laugh rumbled warm beneath her ear, and Lily thought, drowsy and content in the fading candlelight, that she could happily remain in this exact moment for the rest of her life. At the trustees' meeting that followed, Lily sat beside Charles rather than behind him, presenting the mill accounts and the estate reforms with the same clear, confident precision that had first caught his attention weeks earlier. The trustees, watching them together, began to ask sharper questions of Augustus's claims than they had before. The happiness lasted only a single day. A telegram arrived that evening, bearing the correct private code used by Richard Randolph's chambers. Samuel Goodwin arrested. Immediate attendance required. In the same hour, Charles grew suddenly, inexplicably dizzy, his vision swimming, his limbs heavier than the fever of weeks past had ever left them. Captain William Clark was summoned urgently away by a report, later proven false, of trouble at the railway station, and Lily, believing she followed every proper safeguard the household could offer, prepared to leave for London at once. Lily did nothing recklessly. The telegram's code was correct. Charles, fighting through the strange, drugged heaviness, clouding his thoughts, ordered an approved carriage, a trusted driver, and the footman Hugh Bennett to accompany her. Before she climbed into the carriage, Charles caught her hand and pressed a kiss to her forehead, his eyes dark with worry he could not quite hide. "Stay inside the carriage," he said, "unless Hugh tells you it is safe to do otherwise. Send word the moment you reach London." "I will," Lily promised, and meant it. The carriage had not traveled 2 miles before a fallen tree forced it from the main road onto an isolated woodland track. Lily felt the change in the carriage's motion and knew, with cold certainty, that something was wrong before the first shout came from outside. Men surged from the trees, 3 of them, moving with the practiced coordination of hired violence rather than opportunistic crime. Hugh fought fiercely, throwing himself between them and the carriage door with a courage that would haunt Lily for months afterward, his blood staining the snow dark before he went down, still conscious, still calling her name, still fighting to reach her, even as a boot drove the breath from his chest. Lily flung open the carriage door on the far side and ran, her boots sinking into snow that seemed determined to swallow every step, her breath tearing ragged at her throat, the black shapes of bare trees blurring past her at the edges of her vision. For one wild, hopeful moment, she believed she might actually outrun them. Then rough hands closed around her arms and dragged her back. A cloth pressed hard against her mouth to silence her scream, and her mother's cameo brooch tore loose from its chain in the struggle and fell, unnoticed by her captors, into the churned and bloodied snow beside the road. She fought until her strength gave out, memorizing everything she could: the shape of a scarred hand, the particular creak of the second carriage's wheel, the direction the horses turned once they reached the main road again, because Charles had taught her, without ever meaning to, that even a person with no power over her circumstances could still choose to pay careful attention. At Thornwick, William returned to find the railway report false, and Clara Robinson, weeping, confessed that Augustus had questioned her only hours earlier about the exact timing of Lily's departure. Charles's first instinct was to go alone, to demand a horse he could no longer safely ride, to hurl himself into danger by sheer force of will. William caught his arm. "Your Grace, trusting us is not surrendering command." Charles stood very still, breathing hard, the old fear and the new understanding warring visibly across his face. Then, for the first time in 18 months, he set aside the need to do everything alone and began, instead, to lead. "William," he said, his voice suddenly sharp and clear. Every trace of the drugged fog burned away by urgency. "Bring me every property deed connected to the Kensington Trusts within 20 miles. Mabel, send for Elias. I want him ready the moment we find her, whatever condition she is in. Clara," he turned to the weeping maid, his voice gentling only slightly, "tell me everything Augustus asked you. Every word. Do not spare yourself in the telling, and I will not hold your answers against you." Clara, trembling, recounted every question Augustus had pressed upon her over the preceding weeks: the timing of Lily's letters, the route she favored for her morning rides, the names of the servants she trusted most. Charles listened without interrupting, his jaw tight, his mind already assembling the pieces into a shape only he could see. He pulled estate maps, old property records, telegraph lines, everything Clara and John's recovered ledger could offer, and within the hour had narrowed Augustus's likely destination to a single, half-forgotten property. "Stormcroft," he said, tapping the old deed with a steady finger, "the Dower House. I spent the first months of my recovery there, before Thornwick's own entrances were widened. It has a level courtyard built for a wheeled chair, and a private telegraph line I insisted on having installed, back when I still believed I might need to summon help quickly and quietly. Augustus knows the property as well as I do. He knows exactly how to use it against me. William was already reaching for his coat. Then we ride within the hour, Your Grace. We do, Charles agreed. And for the first time since the crash that had killed his brother, he did not once consider attempting the journey alone. Stormcroft House. The old Dower estate, once modified for Charles's early recovery, its ground floor already fitted with the level access his condition required. Lily woke in an unfamiliar chamber, her wrists unbound but her door locked. Augustus seated calmly across from her, as though they were sharing an ordinary afternoon call. You will sign a statement, he said pleasantly, sliding a paper across the table between them, declaring Charles cruel, unstable, unfit to govern his own household. Refuse. And Dr. Wallace has a tonic that will make your refusal appear to be delirium instead. Either way, Duchess, the statement will bear your name by morning. You killed John, Lily said, watching him carefully. The crash was no accident. Augustus's pleasant mask did not so much as flicker. John discovered the trust money I had diverted. He meant to confront me that night. I arranged for Charles's carriage to fail on the bridge. I did not arrange for John to take the reins in his brother's place. That was merely inconvenient. Lily's stomach turned, but she kept her voice level, kept her hands steady on the table. She had learned, from Charles, exactly how much could be hidden behind stillness. Lily kept her voice steady, though her pulse hammered beneath her ribs. You will hang for John's death regardless of what I sign. I will hang for nothing, Augustus said, an edge of real anger finally cracking through his charm, because no one will believe the word of a hysterical duchess over the sworn statement of her own hand. That has always been the elegance of this plan, Duchess. I require nothing from you but your signature and your silence. Everything else, I can arrange myself. She pretended, slowly, to consider signing. While Augustus stepped away to confer with Benedict, Lily crossed swiftly to an old private telegraph instrument, forgotten in the corner of the room, its wires still connected to the estate line. Her fingers shook as she tapped out what letters she could manage, before footsteps sounded in the corridor. Storm! The signal cut off as she fled back to her chair, her heart pounding. But she had done what she could. She dropped her mother's cameo, freed from her sleeve, near the servant's entrance before Augustus returned, and tucked a ledger of his own damning payments deep inside the lining of her gown. Charles arrived at Stormcroft through the level servant's courtyard, his wheelchair moving fast and sure across ground built, ironically, for his own use during his recovery. William and a dozen loyal estate men followed close behind him. The confrontation broke out in the ground floor gunroom, chosen, Lily understood later, precisely because it was the one room in the house Charles could reach without obstacle. Augustus laughed when he saw him. Still rolling to the rescue, cousin. A pity you cannot even stand to fight for her properly. You mistook movement for authority, Charles said, his voice cold and utterly steady. That error has cost you everything. Lily did not wait to be rescued. She struck the sedative from Benedict's hand before he could reach her, hurled open the heavy curtains so William could see clearly into the room, and threw Augustus's forged declaration directly into the fire, watching it curl and blacken. I already sent word, she said, meeting Augustus's furious gaze without flinching. Your ledger is in my possession. It is finished, my lord. Benedict, cornered, began babbling excuses about medical judgment and the necessity of caution, but no one in the room troubled to listen. William seized him as he tried to flee toward the door, twisting his arm firm behind his back, with the brisk efficiency of a man who had subdued far more dangerous opponents in his years beside Charles. Augustus's composure finally shattered, his handsome face twisted into something ugly and desperate, the charm stripped entirely away to reveal the calculating cruelty that had lived beneath it all along. "You think this changes anything?" he snarled at Charles. "You think a chair and a clever wife make you fit to hold what I have spent years planning to take?" "I think," Charles said evenly, "that you have already lost, and simply have not yet finished falling." Seeing the room close around him, Augustus bolted instead through the rear of the house, out into the frozen gardens beyond, and Charles wheeled after him as far as the threshold would allow, shouting orders to the men already giving chase across the moonlit snow. He ran across the lake, the ice groaning beneath his boots, silver moonlight catching on its cracked surface. "Stop!" Charles shouted from the shore, his voice carrying across the still, freezing air. "There is an underground spring on the eastern side. The ice will not hold you." Augustus did not stop. Pride. The same pride that had driven him to sabotage a carriage and murder his own cousin's brother carried him further out onto the thin, treacherous ice. The surface cracked beneath him with a sound like a gunshot. He plunged through into black water, gasping, flailing. William hurled a rope across the ice. Charles, wheeling himself as close to the frozen edge as the men would allow, called out once more, "Take the rope, Augustus. Take it." Augustus, even drowning, even dying, could not bring himself to accept rescue from the cousin he had spent years calling broken. He tried instead to claw his own way toward the shore. The ice gave way entirely beneath him, and the black water closed over his head and did not open again. Later, wrapped in blankets before Stormcroft's hastily lit fire, Lily helped Charles from his soaked coat, her hands trembling now that the danger had finally passed. He allowed his exhaustion to show for the first time all night, his shoulders sagging, his composure finally, completely spent. "I thought I had lost you," he admitted, his forehead resting against her waist, his voice raw. Lily held him, without offering false comfort, without pretending the night had not nearly ended in tragedy. "You did not lose me," she said softly, her fingers threading through his hair. "You came for me, instead." William arrived quietly, with a leather packet recovered from Augustus's coat. Payments to Benedict, instructions concerning Lily's abduction, records connecting Augustus directly to the cut carriage harness that had killed John 18 months earlier. Tucked among the papers, in John's own hand, was a final note. "Augustus must never control Thornwick, whatever it costs me." John had known his own danger and had gone to confront it regardless. Charles held the note for a long moment, grief and something like peace moving across his face in equal measure, before folding it carefully away. The weeks that followed brought Thornwick's long conspiracy fully into the light. Clara's confession proved the forged handwriting. Lady Adeline identified the stationery used in the false love letter as paper from Augustus's own London residence. Dr. Elias Stirling's findings exposed the excessive medication that had kept Charles weaker than his true condition required. John's recovered ledger laid bare years of stolen trust money, funneled through railway shells Augustus had used to fund his own ambitions. Hugh Bennett, recovering slowly from his wounds, identified one of the men who had attacked the carriage. The damaged harness, examined by an independent expert, confirmed deliberate sabotage rather than accident. Dr. Benedict Wallace confessed at last, not to the original crash, but to years of altering Charles's treatment and to assisting directly in Lily's abduction. His resentment, it emerged, traced back decades to a scandal in which Charles's own father had wrongly blamed Benedict's family for a financial failure. Augustus had found that old wound and used it without mercy. "I understand why you hated my father," Charles told him, before the magistrate led him away. "I do not forgive what you did to me, or to my wife." Clara, weeping, expected dismissal. Lily argued for mercy instead. "Augustus trapped her through her brother's debts," Lily told Charles quietly. "Exactly as this family's debts once trapped me. She gave us the truth the moment she was free to give it. That deserves consideration, not punishment." Charles considered this longer than Lily expected, and finally agreed. Clara remained at Thornwick, under Mabel's watchful supervision. Given a second chance, she did not waste. The trustees convened one final time in Thornwick's great hall, and Charles led the proceedings himself, from his wheelchair, without apology or explanation. The evidence against Augustus's claims of incapacity collapsed entirely under the weight of everything Lily and the household had uncovered. Charles's control over his own estates, his own fortune, his own name, was confirmed beyond further challenge. One elderly trustee, Lord Pemberton, who had spent the preceding months quietly aligned with Augustus's claims, rose near the end of the proceedings with obvious discomfort. "Your Grace," he said, "I confess, I allowed myself to be persuaded by arguments I ought to have questioned more carefully. I hope you will accept my apology, and my continued support of your governance." "I accept both," Charles said, without a trace of the coldness Lily might once have expected from him. "We have all been deceived by a man skilled at deception, Lord Pemberton. I hold no grudge against those who were merely careless with their trust, only against the man who abused it." The room murmured its approval, and Lily, seated beside him with the mill accounts still spread across her lap, felt a fierce, quiet pride settle over her chest. He did not need to stand to win. Lily watched him command the room from his chair with steady, unshakable authority, and understood, finally and completely, that his worth had never once depended on his legs. Dr. Sterling delivered his honest prognosis privately, in the library, with Lily present. "You may regain further strength with time and proper treatment," Elias said carefully. "The correct medication will improve your alertness considerably. You may, in time, manage brief unassisted standing, but I will not promise you independent walking, Your Grace. The wheelchair will remain, I believe, a permanent part of your life." Charles absorbed this in silence, his eyes finding Lily's, bracing. She could see it plainly, for whatever disappointment he still expected her to feel. "Then the London chair must be made lighter," Lily said, matter of fact. "And the country chair needs sturdier wheels. Thornwick's garden paths are unforgivably muddy, and I intend for us to walk them together for many years, one way or another." Charles laughed then, openly, freely, a sound entirely unguarded, and Lily thought it might be the finest sound she had ever heard him make. Samuel was fully cleared of any wrongdoing, the mill's mortgages transferred into a trust under Lily's own control, and the workers' cottages repaired at last. Over dinner at Thornwick, Samuel admitted to Charles, with the blunt honesty of youth, that he had prepared himself thoroughly to dislike him. "I intend to disappoint that preparation daily," Charles told him, perfectly solemn, and Samuel's startled laugh filled the dining room with a warmth Thornwick had sorely lacked for 18 long months. "I thought," Samuel admitted later, once the servants had cleared the plates and the fire had burned down to embers, "that a duke who bought his sister would be cruel. I had imagined all manner of terrible scenes, Your Grace. I am rather disappointed to find you so reasonable." I shall endeavor to be less reasonable at our next meeting, Charles said gravely, purely for your comfort. I would appreciate that, Samuel said, grinning. It would make the stories I intend to tell my own children considerably more exciting. Speaking of stories, Charles said, refilling Samuel's glass with the ease of a man who had decided, at last, that he rather liked having a younger brother-in-law at his table. Your sister tells me you draw birds, she says, in the margins of your schoolbooks, when you ought to have been studying your Latin. Samuel flushed. It is only a small habit, Your Grace. Nothing worth mentioning. Thornwick's steward has been complaining for years that our estate records lack any proper illustration of the migratory species on the lake, Charles said. I find I have need of a capable hand, if you are interested in the position. It pays modestly, but the hours are flexible, and the company, I am told, is tolerable. Samuel looked to Lily, astonished, and she smiled and said nothing, letting him find his own way to the answer, already written plainly across his face. Lily, watching the easy warmth between them, felt something in her chest loosen that had been tight with worry since the morning she had first walked into Randolph's chambers. Samuel was safe. The mill was safe. Her aunt would want for nothing, and the man across the table, who had once terrified half of London with a single sentence, was laughing freely with her brother over the last of the evening's wine, as though Thornwick had always been the kind of house where such laughter belonged. In the library where they had first met, Charles gave Lily a stack of legal documents. Samuel's safety confirmed, the estate's claim closed, the mill secured in her name, her aunt's income guaranteed, and, beneath it all, papers granting Lily her own independent fortune and the legal right to leave him, without scandal, without losing a single thing she had gained. There is no debt between us now, Charles said quietly. And what remains? Lily asked, though she already suspected the answer. Only what you freely choose, he said. He told her, gently, that a carriage could carry her to London the following morning, should she wish it. Lily set the papers aside without reading them further. She crossed the room, knelt before his chair until their eyes met level with each other, and took his hands in hers. Ask me, she said, as Charles, not as the Duke who saved my family. His breath caught. His fingers tightened around hers. Lily Goodwin, he said, his voice rough with everything he had spent 18 months refusing to feel. Will you remain my wife, because you wish to, and for no other reason on this earth? Yes, Lily said, without a single moment's hesitation. Yes, Charles, I choose you. Not the mill, not the settlement, not the safety you gave Samuel. You. Charles's throat worked, as though the words had struck somewhere far deeper than he had prepared himself to be struck. I spent so long believing that love, for a man like me, would always arrive wrapped in obligation, he said quietly. That no one could ever choose this, his hand gestured, briefly, toward the chair beneath him, toward the whole of what he had once believed made him unworthy. Freely, and completely, without also grieving what I could not give them. You have given me everything that matters, Lily said, cupping his face in both hands. A home, a family restored to safety, a partner who listens when I speak, and trusts me when it costs him something to do so. I do not grieve what you cannot do, Charles. I have never once grieved it. I only ever wanted the man who remained. He kissed her then, seated, steady, complete exactly as he was, and Lily understood that this quiet moment mattered more than any grand, standing proposal ever could have. He had never needed to rise from that chair to be worthy of love. He had only needed someone willing to see the whole of him and choose him anyway. Outside the library windows, the last of winter's frost had begun to soften into the first thaw of spring, and somewhere beyond the gardens, the frozen lake that had claimed Augustus's life had already begun, slowly and quietly, to run clear again beneath the returning sun. Months later, when spring had finally softened the frost from Thornwick's gardens, the great ballroom opened once more, its chandeliers blazing, its floor filled with dancing couples for the first time in years. Charles moved among his guests openly in his chair, no longer hidden behind a side courtyard or a locked door, no longer ashamed of the wheels that carried him. When the musicians struck a slow waltz, he rose carefully, braced by his cane and by Lily's steady hand, and gave her the single turn about the floor he had promised himself he would give her, so long ago, alone and falling in a dusty, abandoned room. When his strength finally faded, he sat again without a flicker of shame, and Lily remained beside him, her hand in his, and they continued their dance seated, fingers intertwined, while the other couples moved gracefully around them. Mabel watched them from the edge of the room, a handkerchief pressed unashamedly to her eyes, while Phoebe leaned against William's arm and declared, with great satisfaction, that she had finally found a circumstance worth smiling for. Samuel, grown taller and steadier in the month since the trial, danced twice with a tenant's daughter and blushed furiously each time Lily caught his eye across the room. Lady Adeline, who had come to stand as godmother to whatever child the future might bring them, raised her glass quietly toward Charles from across the hall, and he returned the gesture with a warmth that finally held no trace of old guilt. Later, when the guests had gone and the candles had burned low, Charles wheeled himself to the tall ballroom windows where rain no longer fell. Only soft spring starlight over the gardens he had once refused to be seen crossing. Lily came to stand behind him, her hands resting on his shoulders, and felt him lean back, unguarded, into her touch. "I used to believe," he said quietly, "that this house would only ever see me as broken, that I would spend my life entering through side doors, hiding what my body could no longer do, waiting for someone to look at me and see only the chair. And now? Now I think," Charles said, turning his head to press a kiss against her knuckles, "that I was never broken at all, only waiting for the one person who would never once mistake the chair for the whole of me." Lily bent and kissed him, slow and certain, the way she had learned to kiss him, without hesitation, without pity, without a single glance toward anything but his eyes. The final image Thornwick's guests carried home that night was not of a duke who had somehow learned to walk again. It was of a duke who had finally learned that he had never needed to. If this story moved you, hit like. It really helps. Subscribe for more slow burn duke romances like this one. Share it with a friend who loves a good love story. And tell me in the comments, where are you watching from? Thanks for staying till the end. See you in the next one.